Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Premiere 8, the Essentials of Eliminating Bad Bugs conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, January 28th, 2009. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Lauren Solis with Premiere Inc. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mohammed. Good afternoon from Charlotte. We know it's going to take a couple minutes for everybody to get logged on here. There's been a little bit of confusion because we've had such a good turnout. So if you've got questions, go ahead and chat me, and as soon as I'm done giving them a couple of brief announcements, I'll get back and make sure that we can all get on. As I said, I've got a few quick announcements before I turn the call over to Dr. Leslie Schultz. She's Premier's Director of Knowledge Transfer, and she'll be introducing our speaker today. Following the presentation, the operator will tell you how to ask a question, but you may also submit your questions during the presentation through the chat feature, and we'll keep track of them, and we'll also we'll ask those to the doctor at the end as well. The webcast is being recorded and will be posted to our Advisor Live website within 24 hours. The slide presentation is already posted there. The last slide in this presentation contains information on how to receive your continuing education credit for participating today. Again, the slides are already posted on the Advisor Live homepage at premiereinc.com. You don't need to write anything down. You can log on and download the CE information. Again, I want to thank you all for being patient and participating today. I'm now going to turn the call over to Dr. Leslie Schultz to get us started. Leslie?
Thank you, Lauren, and welcome, everyone. On today's call, we are honored to have Dr. Robert Weinstein, the Chief Operating Officer of the Outpatient Ruth M. Rothstein Core Center for the Prevention, Care, and Research of Infectious Diseases. He is also the Interim Chairman of Medicine at the John Stroger, formerly Cook County, Hospital, and the C. Anderson Hedberg Professor of Medicine at Rush University Medical College. So I can assure you we are in absolutely excellent hands today. Dr. Weinstein, welcome, and let's turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. So today we're going to be talking about the essentials of eliminating bad bugs, and you can see on the cover slide that my disclosures are grant funding from Sage Products and also from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Next slide, please. The talk is going to cover traditional forces behind resistance as a background, and then I will focus on the traditional prevention measures, and I've divided them into five areas, and I'll talk about each of those five areas. Then I'll talk about some newer uses of chlorhexidine that has gotten a lot of interest in our research activities, and I think is beginning to catch on across the country and very exciting. Then I want to talk about new laws and mandates to give you a sense of what's going on in the federal government, and then summarize with take-home messages. Next slide. So this is background information. It's clear that without interventions, antibiotic resistance keeps increasing. And on this slide, there's a figure from the American Journal of Infection Control from the CDC, from the NNIS, National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System, which has now been superseded by the NHSN, National Healthcare Safety Network of the CDC. Increasing numbers of hospitals are joining this system, and so the data are becoming more and more robust. But the antibiotic resistance data we have relates mostly to the last decade and the current decade. And you can see for along the left-hand side of the slide are various bug-drug combinations, so vancomycin resistance and enterococci, methicillin resistance and Staph aureus, various resistances in different gram-negative bacteria. And the bar represents data from 1998 through 2002, and the dot represents 2003. And you can see for most bug-drug combinations, resistance has increased in ICUs across the country. And this is continuing to go on. Next slide, please. A question that often comes up is, What are the clinical implications of antibiotic resistance? That is, for many years, it was thought that antibiotic-resistant bacteria and fungi and viruses were wimpier than their susceptible counterparts. And the idea was that the genetic machinery that it required to become resistant took away from some of the virulence and pathogenicity factors, and so that the bacteria couldn't behave as badly while they were spending all the time becoming antibiotic resistant. Well, it's probably not the case. And here you can see a summation of a number of studies looking at hospital length of stay, hospital charges, and mortality as three major clinically important outcome measures, comparing those outcomes for patients who have infections with resistant bacteria compared to those who have infections with the similar bacteria but susceptible. So methicillin-resistant Staph aureus compared to methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus, vancomycin-resistant enterococci compared to vancomycin-susceptible enterococci, and then a number of gram-negatives that are either resistant to the newer antibiotics or susceptible. And you can see that for length of stay, hospital charges, and mortality, there is up to five times worse outcome for patients who are infected with the resistant bacteria. So clearly, antibiotic resistance has a major clinical impact. Next slide. So what are the interventions that are necessary to control resistance? Well, they're driven by the dynamics of resistance and the forces behind resistance. And you can see this is a cartoon from a paper of ours a number of years ago that looks at the dynamics of nosocomial resistance. And this is basically an iceberg, and over the top of the iceberg is the hand of a healthcare worker, because unwashed, uncleaned, under-germed hands of healthcare workers are thought to be a major factor in moving bacteria back and forth from one patient to the next. Also on the right-hand side, you can see a number of other factors, and I want to highlight environmental contamination and antibiotic pressures, and we'll talk about those. And then on the left-hand side, you see transfers, readmission, nursing home patients. This is from an article from 1981, so if I were going to update this, I'd probably add LTACs, long-term acute care hospitals, all of which move patients back and forth to acute care hospitals and move resistance around. And then finally is the submerged portion of the iceberg. And what that submerged portion represents is the finding over a number of years, and these are data going back 20 or 30 years, that for every patient you find who's clinically infected with an antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you're going to have 2 to 10 additional patients who are colonized, that is, are carrying that bacteria in their gut, in their stool, on their skin, in their sputum, in their noses, but who are not showing up as clinically infected and therefore have never been cultured, but are sitting there as this silent iceberg waiting to cause transmission problems in the hospital. Okay, so that's the dynamics of resistance, and all of our interventions are really driven by this epidemiologic understanding. And so now I want to go to the next slide, and I'm going to talk about the first of the five traditional measures to control antibiotic resistance and to control hospital infections in general. The first is hand hygiene. And so alcohol, just like we've learned for the heart with red wine, is good for you, at least in moderation. Alcohol is good for the hands, too. And alcohol hand rubs, which have been used in Europe for several decades, finally caught on in the United States about 7 or 8 years ago when HCPCS, the CDC's Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, generated guidelines for hand hygiene that really emphasized the use of alcohol hand rubs. And with that, I think hospitals all over the country moved to installing dispensers of alcohol gel inside or outside patient rooms. And actually, when compared to traditional soap and water, and even with medicated soap and water, alcohol hand rubs are faster, as or more effective, and are better accepted. In fact, most of these rubs have emollients in them that improve hand hygiene and also improve hand condition. So these are tremendously great addition to our hand hygiene armamentarium. The question is how to get people to use them on a regular basis. And the next slide shows what I think is kind of an innovative approach on the next slide to hand hygiene. It's a study that was presented at the SHEA, the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, annual meeting in 2006. And I haven't seen the publication of this yet, but basically these two hospitals that were having problems with MRSA infections took a traffic school approach. That is, anybody who didn't clean their hands was found by a hand hygiene monitor, kind of like a traffic cop, to enter or leave a patient room without performing appropriate hand hygiene, was required to take remedial educational tutorial about hand hygiene. And the more often you failed to clean your hands, the more often you were caught, the more tutorials you caught, in an escalating fashion to the point of either dismissal or for repeated violations. And with this sort of pretty severe sanctioning, hand hygiene adherence improved dramatically, 85 to 100% for all healthcare workers and almost unbelievably 95% to physicians. And with this, the bacterial outbreak that prompted the monitoring and this discipline resolved. Now, key to this, obviously, is having leaders that monitor hand hygiene and use disciplinary action as they would for any serious infraction. So this had leadership buy-in in the hospital and required a system of surveillance to actually find people who are not using hand hygiene. I know some infection preventionists find this distasteful because they look at this as being more of a police person, but sometimes this is what it takes to get the job done. Now, if you improve hand hygiene and get above the 50 to 60%, which is where a lot of hospitals are, will you see benefit? The next slide shows one of the benefits, potentially, of hand hygiene. So it's interesting that it's been difficult to prove the benefit of hand hygiene beyond the seminal work of Semmelweis. As you know, Ignaz Semmelweis, all of you know, showed the importance of hand hygiene in reducing rates of puerperal sepsis in the Allgemeine Krankenhaus, the sick hospital where he worked. And so since then, it's actually been hard to prove that hand hygiene makes a difference. And so I thought this was an interesting study that showed over a four-year period, a series of educational courses for healthcare workers improved hand hygiene. So the dotted line at the top of the slide shows hand hygiene rates, which were in the 40% range and improved up to about 80%. 75-80%. With this, the solid line that crosses the dotted line shows the number of antimicrobial resistant isolates that were recovered per 1,000 patient days. And you can see a drop in antimicrobial resistant bacteria, almost a halving of it, at least a 33% drop over time. And this is with a continued influx of antibiotic-resistant bacteria from the community. You can see the bottom line is the community acquired resistance, which didn't change over time. So hand hygiene, the dotted line went up, and antibiotic resistance in the acquired in the hospital, the top solid line, went down. So clearly, hand hygiene is a benefit. It's worth trying to push it, and there are ways to improve hand hygiene. Whether it's the carrot or the stick, you have to decide at your own hospital. Next slide shows the second of the five issues, and that's the issue of surveillance cultures, isolation, and decolonization. And so I wanted to introduce that topic with this slide, which is supposed to summarize a search and destroy approach, which is the Dutch strategy that is very popular now for controlling MRSA. That is, you do active surveillance cultures of patients when they come in the hospital. If they're colonized with MRSA, you put them on contact precautions, and this is said to control the spread of MRSA. Now, isolation precautions have been practiced since the Middle Ages. This is nothing new, and this figure, I'd like to always talk about this figure, which is a healthcare provider in the Middle Ages during the plague era when, of course, they didn't know anything about germs. The germ theory wasn't introduced until the mid-1800s, so they knew nothing about germs. But they knew that if you got too close to someone who had plague, you might catch it. And so what the healthcare providers did was wear gowns, gloves, and masks, just like we do now. You can see this person, the gown, the glove, and the mask. The mask here has a little beak on it because they used to pour perfume into the beak because I guess the Middle Ages, all those rotting bodies must have been a horrific odor. Additionally, you can see they have a stick because they'd see a patient with plague and they'd want to know if the patient was dead or not, and so they'd poke the patient with the stick. And we don't use sticks now, but we do use interns. Next slide is kind of a pro and con summary of the value of active surveillance cultures and contact precautions for controlling MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus. So on the side favoring the use of active surveillance cultures, so nasal swabs or nasal plus other swabs, are the iceberg effect that I showed you. So if you just rely on clinical culture results, you're missing maybe two-thirds of the patients who are MRSA carriers and would be sources of spread and then never isolated. Second is that there are clinical trials, and I'll show you one, that have shown benefit of the active surveillance technique. Third is there's a lot of cost, morbidity, and mortality to resistant bugs, and I've shown you that already. Fourth is I showed you resistance is increased, so whatever we've been doing hasn't been working. Fifth is there is a need for action. Patient advocates and payers are not happy that there's resistance and want us to do something. And finally, four states, including Illinois, require some form of active surveillance. In Illinois, the requirement is all ICU and high-risk patients be cultured on admission, and all Veterans Administration hospitals. Now, Veterans Administration hospitals, it's a funded mandate in them. They've supplied personnel and monies to do this. In the four states, it is unfunded mandate. Now, the cons, the negatives, is that basically the trials are quasi-experimental. Almost all are. That is, they're before-after studies. Lots of things are implemented. They're often done in outbreak settings. And so is it the active surveillance that really makes a difference? The second is the cost-benefit is not clear. The data are not very strong. The attributable mortality, are the patients dying because of the MRSA, or are people getting the MRSA because they're very ill and they're going to die anyway? This is not an approach that necessarily fits all hospitals. There are some adverse effects to being in isolation, and they have been studied carefully in most of these studies. Those hospitals like the Netherlands that have no MRSA, their overall infection rates are exactly the same as ours, so they've just replaced MRSA with other bugs. They haven't really eliminated infections, they've just eliminated MRSA. And finally, the surveillance culture is doing the nose enough, or should you do other things? Well, I want to show you three recent studies that give both the pros and cons. The next slide shows the first of the three studies, and this is a positive study. It's from the Chicagoland area, from Evanston Hospital in Evanston, and from a series of three hospitals that are affiliated. And it looked at universal surveillance for methicillin-resistant staph aureus. Next slide is the major outcome slide. This is a segmented regression model, so it's kind of a fancy test. And ignore the red line for now, and just look at there are three time periods basically here that are delineated by horizontal lines. The first one runs from August 03 to August 04. And during that time period was a baseline period, and you can see the flat line there, the horizontal line, is supposed to be an average of all the up and down lines, which basically shows the prevalence density per 10,000 patient days of MRSA positive cultures. In August 04, these researchers began an active surveillance in their ICUs. And they did this from August 04 to August 05. And you can see there's a flat line there also, a slightly sloping up line. And what they say is that they did not see any reduction in resistance with the ICU-based surveillance. So then in August of 05, or a little bit after, they implemented hospital-wide active surveillance. And they did a couple other things. They improved hand hygiene education. They used a rapid PCR-based test, so the results were back very quickly, so they could isolate patients on the same day rather than waiting for conventional culture results. And some patients, about 60% of MRSA-positive patients, were given decolonization with nasal mupirocin. And so with this, they felt that the rates of MRSA infection, the prevalence density there for 10,000 patient days, dropped. And you can see the horizontal line from August 05 to April 07 is lower than the previous two time periods. And so their conclusion is that active surveillance with PCR, that is polymerase chain reaction for a rapid diagnosis of MRSA carriage and rapid isolation of patients, led to control of MRSA. Now, I've superimposed on this a red line. That red line represents what I think is the drop over time from August of 03 to April of 07, and that they didn't have really a stair-step-like drop, but they had a gradual drop over time. Why do I think that may have occurred? On the next slide are data from the CDC, and this slide shows trends in central line-associated bloodstream infections caused by Staph aureus and ICUs that were monitored by NNIS, NIS, and then by NHSN. And you can see in the red line that I've superimposed on the pink line is MRSA bloodstream infection rates, which fell from 0.4 per thousand central line days down to less than 0.2. So a 50% decline in MRSA related to the introduction in 02 of central line guidelines from HCPCS. So the question is whether the Evanston experience represents a natural change over time that other people are seeing in MRSA infection rates, or really the impact of their intervention. It's hard to tell because it's a quasi-experimental study with before-after comparisons instead of contemporary controls, and also a number of other things were done in that hospital system, including mupirocin use, greater hand hygiene, a greater education. Now, the third study is on the next slide. And so if we go to the next slide, you can see this is another article from 2008 that looked at universal screening for MRSA at hospital admission and looked at nosocomial infection risk, and they focused on surgical patients. What they basically did was take a number of wards and divide the wards up. And half the wards at their hospital, they made screening wards where they did nasal swabs with rapid testing and isolation of patients. And the other half of the wards, they did standard care. And then after 9 months, they switched the wards. So those wards that had been rapid screening wards became routine care wards, and the wards that had been routine care wards became rapid screening wards. So they had contemporary controls that makes it a much stronger study. Next slide shows the major outcomes. And in the next slide, you can see that group 1 wards, go back one slide, please. Can we go back one slide there? Thank you. This slot, now forward a slide. Good, that's it. So this is the incidence of MRSA infections in the group 1 wards, which were first rapid screening wards and then became control wards, and the group 2 wards, which were control wards when the group 1 wards were rapid screening, and then when the group 1 wards became control, the group 2 wards became rapid screening. And basically, there is no difference in time across either wards, that is from the study period 1 to study period 2, and there is also no difference within a study period between the rapid screening and the control ward. So basically, there was no difference between rapid screening and the routine care, suggesting that rapid screening was not a benefit. Now, each of these studies clearly had drawbacks, problems, issues. This study, though, is the only published study that really shows controlled data. And so I think that the fact that it's controlled data trumps any of the other kind of nuances in terms of the validity of the data. Now the next slide is the third slide, and that's, if you think about it, and you're someone who comes in the hospital, and you're cultured, and you're found to be MRSA positive, and you're isolated, if you're a smart person, you might say, well, you're isolating me to protect the guy next door. What are you going to do to protect me? And that's where the paper from Evanston, I thought, made an important advance. And that is, they looked at the benefit of decolonization. Although, because it was a four-after study and only 60% of the patients got decolonization because decolonization wasn't studied in a very carefully or regimented way, I think it's hard to make any conclusions. Nevertheless, that is an issue that you will confront if you isolate patients with MRSA. And so I just wanted to show you this one recent study that looked at ways to decolonize people, and this includes chlorhexidine gluconate washing, intranasal mupirocin, and oral rifampin and doxycycline. Most people just use the intranasal compound. These people were considering the fact that patients might decolonize at multiple body sites. Next slide show their results. And you can see that the probability of remaining culture negative, that's staying at the top of the slide, that's the upper curve, which is the dashed line. And you can see that the probability of remaining culture negative, 100% virtually of patients who got decolonization were culture negative within a couple of days. But over about 100 to 200 days, so a third of a year to two-thirds of a year, patients became recolonized, and by the end of about two-thirds of a year, about 50% of those people who had been decolonized were recolonized. So this is a short-term benefit for short-term stay patients, and how it works in a longer-term stay remains to be studied. Next slide. So that's the first two topics are hand hygiene and antibiotic surveillance. I want to turn now to antibiotic use and just comment quickly that antibiotics, the more you use them, the faster you lose them, but doctors can improve their antibiotic prescribing. The next slide shows examples of the antibiotic prescribing process on the left-hand side, and then in the dotted box on the right-hand side are several points at which you can intervene. And I wanted to just comment on each of these points. So education and guidelines actually do improve antibiotic prescribing. Antibiotic cycling does not. People have thought that antibiotic cycling would be a great thing to do. So for a month you use antibiotic A, and the next month everybody needs general antibiotic therapy, gets antibiotic B, which is a different mechanism of action and therefore would have different resistance selection pressures. And by cycling the pressures over time, you'd kind of confuse the bacteria and they'd give up. It hasn't worked. The third, formulary restrictions, does work. Computer-assisted strategies work, and feedback and review work. So four of these work. The education, the restrictions, the computer-assisted strategies, and the feedback, those all work. Antibiotic cycling does not. And the next slide is just an example of how beneficial antibiotic stewardship can be. This is a long-term care unit with antimicrobial days and starts. And so the black line is antimicrobial days. The dotted line is antimicrobial starts. This shows data over a five-year period. And you can see there were teaching sessions, and these were about 1 to 2 hour sessions over 2 years, so not very onerous or cumbersome to do this. 8 years over a total of 2 years of teaching, and some of the sessions were only 1 hour. And you can see that with that, there was almost a 50% drop in the number of antibiotic days, and that this was sustained over a two-year period, which is pretty impressive that this can happen. So I think education can be very beneficial. Next slide is the fourth of the five traditional measures that I'm going to talk about, and that's device bundles. Basically, this gets at the issue of to prevent infections, you will prevent resistance. So if you prevent infections, you're preventing resistance, and this example is the guideline for prevention of vascular catheter-related infections, which is actually boils down to five prevention measures. Next slide. And you can see this is the device-related infection prevention measures. Each of these has been proven to be effective in a randomized controlled trial. So education of personnel about inserting catheters, removing catheters that are no longer needed, that are idle and just sitting there, chlorhexidine prep rather than iodophore, using maximum barrier precautions for insertion of catheters, and then use of coated catheters, that is antiseptic or anti-infective coating, that's been controversial. And when these guidelines were developed, a number of people came in front of the CDC's Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory, HICPAC, to comment on the guidelines. And one of the most contentious issues was coated catheters. Half of the people who came up said, if you don't recommend universal use of coated catheters, patients will die and the blood will be on your hands. The other half said, the data are so poor to recommend this that if you recommend this, you'll be costing the country huge sums of money without any benefit. And so the The conclusion of that committee, HCPAC, was to make the statement that use coated catheters only if after full implementation of the above four measures, that is education, removing unneeded catheters, glucosamine prep, and maximum barrier precaution, the institutional goals for control are not met. And I think most hospitals actually have not gone to coated catheters, have just used those four. Now, although each of these four measures has been shown in a randomized trial to be effective, actually the five too, a lot of people would argue that coated catheters have been shown in randomized trials to be effective in terms of preventing infections. No one really has looked at what the added value is of adding all five of them together. So is there a benefit would two of the five work? Would three of the five work? No one knows. But most of the bundles include all of these. Next slide, please. And you can see on the next slide is a study from Michigan that was published about 2 years ago in which 108 ICUs participated in the Keystone study, studied up to 18 months, almost 400,000 catheter days. And what they did was they took this bundle of HCPAC recommendations, made a checklist, empowered the nurses in the unit to stop insertion of a catheter if the checklist wasn't followed, and put together a procedure cart so that all of the supplies were necessary were present in one place. And with this, they saw a 2/3 decrease in the vascular catheter-related bloodstream infection rates, and down to, for many, many hospitals, zero infection rates. So this is a very, very, I think, dramatic demonstration that this sort of device-related intervention can be very, very effective. Next slide, please. And there's a nice recent compendium from the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology that's published in ICHI in October 2008 that basically looks at central line bloodstream infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, surgical site infections, urinary tract infections, so the four major sites of nosocomial infection, most of which are device or procedure related, and then also MRSA and C. difficile, and looks at those six, gives recommendations for those six, a compendium of recommendations. There are probably 100 to 200 recommendations overall or more in the document, which I've tried to boil down on the next slide to what I think are the preventing device infections essentials. And so people may take question with some of this, and in fact in the question and answer period it'd be interesting to hear people's thoughts on it, but my administration came to me and said, look, we can't do 200 things, but if you tell us a few things, we can maybe devote a lot of resources to them. So this is my take on that compendium. First, over all of this is hand hygiene. So you've got to improve hand hygiene. All right. Then once you get beyond hand hygiene, for CVC, BSIs, central vascular catheter bloodstream infections, I think chlorhexidine prep and barrier precautions for putting in the catheters and removing catheters when a patient leaves an ICU or when a catheter has not been used for 24 hours, it comes out. For VAP, ventilator-associated pneumonia, I think oral chlorhexidine and sedation vacations, which are useful to help speed up removing the tube and getting the people off the ventilator, and then positioning. Now, sitting people up at 30 to 45 degrees, I think, is a great idea, although in practice it's very, very hard to do. It's almost mission impossible or position impossible. Nevertheless, I think it's worth trying to do. Surgical site infections, CHG prep, again, antibiotic prophylaxis and timing, and a good surgeon. And here I think the surgeon is very important, but antibiotic prophylaxis, timing, and CHG prep I think are also useful. And then finally, for urinary tract infections, closed systems and catheter removal. And I guess the other issue is, and I didn't add it on here because I think it's not as well studied, but bedside ultrasound, which about 30% of hospitals now use, I think it's probably very useful in terms of monitoring the need for insertion of Foley catheters. So that's the device-related look at device bundles and preventing device-related infections. Prevent device-related infections, you'll prevent a lot of resistance. And then the last of the five traditional measures is on the next slide. And this shows raises the issue of environmental cleaning. There's been a pendulum about the environment. It's gone back and forth. The environment is in the 60s, was all of nosocomial infections were attributed to environmental contamination. In the by the 80s, people thought, no, the environment doesn't really play any role. You just have to worry about people's hands and so forth. And now we're looking that the environment does seem to play a role for five bugs, at least five bacteria: VRE, vancomycin-resistant enterococci, Clostridium difficile, Acinetobacter, MRSA, and Pseudomonas. For those five bugs, VRE, C. difficile, Acinetobacter, MRSA, and Pseudomonas, for those five bugs, it does appear that the environment does play a role. And then there's a role for some viruses like noroviruses and some fungi like Aspergillus and Mucor. Basically, this is kind of a complicated figure, but the bottom line is that routine cleaning in the rush ICU, routine cleaning of rooms, reduced VRE transmission by 60%. And so I think cleaning the environment is important for those five bacteria: VRE, C. diff, Acinetobacter, Pseudomonas, and MRSA. Next slide. Just to comment a moment on C. diff, it's taking more and more interest, and it will continue to get more and more interest, and you can see the reason why. This is some these are some data from CDC showing that almost a doubling of the rates of diagnosis of C. difficile in hospitals over the last few years. So there's going to be more and more attention. How do we deal with this? I think you have to diagnose it promptly. I think treating patients promptly, and then I think bleaching the environment. But the data are controversial, but I do believe that that is a reasonable way to go. Now, last topic, infection control use, or next to the last topic, infection control uses of chlorhexidine. So on the next slide, I list the traditional uses of chlorhexidine, the newer barrier applications, and the newest roles. Next slide, please. So the next slide, when it comes up, will show traditional uses, which is part of the CBC site bundles, as pre-op preps and as hand scrubs. The newer barrier applications are impregnated devices, and the newest roles, back one slide, please. Can we go back one slide? The newest roles are source control. And source control consists of mucosal antisepsis and patient cleansing. And so on this slide, you can see mucosal antisepsis. So this is the efficacy of oral mucosal chlorhexidine in preventing ventilator-associated pneumonia. And there have been a number of trials, and this figure shows a meta-analysis of seven trials showing about a 30% reduction in rates of ventilator-associated pneumonia in patients who have had daily mucosal antisepsis with chlorhexidine while on the ventilator. Next slide, please. The next slide shows not only oral antisepsis, but also nasal antisepsis with chlorhexidine, which is not available in the United States, in a series of cardiac surgery patients. So, Lauren, the next slide, please. Well, when the next slide comes up, it's an article from JAMA that's a randomized controlled trial of chlorhexidine decontamination of the nose and oral pharynx of patients. And next slide, please. I don't know if people's slides are advancing, but the screen I'm looking at, the slides are not advancing. But when they do advance, you'll see a table that shows outcomes in a series of surgical wound infections in patients who had chlorhexidine in the mouth and nose versus those who had placebo, and marked reductions of wound infections, lower respiratory infections, and overall nosocomial infections. That takes us to the other newest role of chlorhexidine, which is patient cleansing. So, Lauren, can we advance the slide? Two more slides. We need to go two more slides ahead to the slide that says patient cleansing with chlorhexidine for source control. Well, eventually we'll get there, I guess. In the meantime, I'll tell you about it. What we did was at Rush in Cook County, we decided that patients in ICUs frequently are colonizing their skin with antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It's kind of a fecal veneer or fecal patina of gut organisms that patients get on their skin. And we thought if we could clean patients' skin off, then we would be able to reduce risks of infection and risks of spread of bacteria. So we did the first study using vancomycin-resistant enterococci as our outcome measure. And what we did was we compared soap and water bathing to chlorhexidine bathing to non-medicated cloths over a series of 5 months for each of these activities. So for 5 months, patients in the ICU got soap and water cleansing. The next 5 months, they got chlorhexidine cleansing. And the last 5 months, they got non-medicated baths. With this, we saw a marked reduction in transmission of VRE during the time period when we used chlorhexidine cloths. And basically what we found was lower skin contamination rates by about 50%. We got rid of the fecal patina by daily cleansing with chlorhexidine. This led to lower environmental contamination rates, which were monitored on a prospective basis, led to lower hand carriage rates of healthcare workers, which were monitored on a prospective basis, and led to 60% reduction in patient transmission or acquisition of VRE, which was monitored prospectively. And with this as a secondary outcome, I don't know if we can advance the slides. Mine aren't advancing, but the next slide, if yours are advancing, shows chlorhexidine bathing reduced incidence of bloodstream infections. And you can see, if you have a slide in front of you, that the rate of bloodstream infections dropped from about the 8 to 10 range down to 0.5 infections per 1,000 patient days when we used CHG, and we stopped using CHG and went back up again. Now, it didn't go back up to 8 to 10. It went back up to the 4 range because, like every place else, our infection rates were going down overall, but during the CHG period, they went down tenfold lower than during subsequent periods. And this was accomplished with CHG bathing, and the next slide, if you have it, shows the rates of skin reactions, and basically the bottom of that slide that says change in skin assessment score from admission to discharge shows, if you just read the very bottom of the slide, it says worsening more likely in soap and water arm than in CHG. So there was a statistically significantly better skin outcome if you got CHG than if you got soap and water, again because the CHG had emollients and various other potions in it that improved skin outcome. Now, because this was a quasi-experimental study, we wanted to do a controlled trial in which bloodstream infections were our primary outcome. And so that's the next slide. It's an article from JAMA, from the Archives of Internal Medicine that's titled Effectiveness of Chlorhexidine Bathing to Reduce Catheter-Associated Bloodstream Infections in Medical Intensive Care Unit Patients. And the next slide, you can see what we did there was a crossover study in which we have two MICUs at Cook County Hospital, Stroger Hospital now, and one of them, the patients were assigned to get chlorhexidine baths on a random basis, that is, the unit was chosen randomly, and for 6 months, everybody in there got chlorhexidine daily wipes, and then after 6 months, that unit changed to soap and water baths, and the other unit started with soap and water baths, and then after 6 months, went to chlorhexidine cloths. And with that, on the next slide, you can see that there was a dramatic and statistically significant reduction in bloodstream infection rates in those patients who were getting the chlorhexidine daily baths. And the next slide shows actually a trend towards even decreased mortality in those patients. And then the following slide shows unpublished or abstract presentation only of what happened in real life after these two studies, one at Rush and one in County, were over. The Rush MICU decided to institute chlorhexidine cleansing as a routine basis. We had no involvement in that. They decided they'd take it up. And with this, you can see their infection rates went from an average of about 4 per 1,000 patient days down to 0. So very effective in real life. Okay, well, if your slides are moving and mine are not, we're going to go to recent laws and national mandates, and this is the last topic. There's been a lot of interest nationally from patient advocates, from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal government, Consumers Union, to try to develop programs nationally that will improve patient outcomes and eliminate healthcare acquired infections. And so there are four bulleted on that slide. Quality improvement initiatives, I'll show you an example. Paying for good performance, that is, if you meet certain benchmarks, you get paid a little bit more. Monetary penalties, that is, if you have certain problems, you don't get paid for them. And finally, public reporting. So let's just look at three of those. The next slide shows quality improvement initiatives. And this is SCIP, which is a Surgical Acute Care Improvement Project, which is a national project, which I think is very exciting and has a great potential to improve surgical outcomes, infection, and other outcomes. The next slide is a summary of those first 10 healthcare-acquired conditions for which CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has said that as of October 1, 2008, it will no longer pay. So if you come in and have open heart surgery, you get whatever the Medicare DRG is for open heart surgery. If you get a mediastinal infection after that and stay in the hospital in a prolonged fashion in the past, your DRG would be upgraded, and the hospital get more money. Now the DRG is not upgraded, and the hospital gets no additional money. They just get the money for the baseline diagnosis. And three of those never events for which the feds will not pay are catheter-associated infections, vascular catheter-associated infections, mediastinus after open heart surgery, and catheter-associated UTIs. And you can read the others. And every year there will be new ones added. So they've already listed the new ones for this coming year, released for public comment. The next slide is the last slide is mandatory reporting of infections in 2008. And that's a slide from the APIC website that shows which states are requiring public reporting of healthcare-associated infections. Illinois is one of them. And there are three basic tenets. The first is that hospitals report rates will work to lower them. That is, what is measured improves. And I believe that is true. There are data that support that if you measure something, you try to improve it. The next two basic tenets, that is, hospitals that report lower rates are safer and that informed patients will obtain safer care, there are no data to support those. I don't know if those are true or not. But it is clear that if you report rates, you will work to lower them. So basically, I say for better infection control, measure infection control better. All right, the last slide, and I hope your slides are moving forward better than mine, is the take-home measures. So take-home measures. One, antibiotic resistance and healthcare-acquired infections are unacceptable to payers and patients, and they should be unacceptable. Two is that attention to basic control measures helps. That is, hand hygiene and antimicrobial stewardship, as I've shown, reduce risk of antimicrobial resistance. And then last is there's increasing emphasis on 5 points that I've reviewed today. The first is the use of infection control bundles to prevent device-related infections, and I gave you kind of my boiled down version of the essentials. The second increasing emphasis is on surveillance cultures for MRSA. I personally favor device-related interventions, and I think that's the way to prevent resistance by preventing those infections. The third is environmental decontamination, which is the specific bugs that I mentioned, particularly VRE, C. difficile, Acinetobacter, MRSA, and Pseudomonas. And then the new laws of monetary awards and penalties, the carrot and the stick, and public reporting, which I think you're all familiar with. And finally, source control with chlorhexidine, cleaner patients, lead to cleaner environments, lead to cleaner healthcare worker hands, which lead to less multi-drug resistant organisms and less bloodstream infections. And with that, I guess we can open up the telephone lines for questions and answers. Thank you very much.
Dr. Weinstein, thank you. That was just fabulous. So clean hands, alcohol is good for us, clean patient, clean environment, bundles, and Dr. Weinstein's short list of essentials. At this point in time, let's open it up for questions. And Mohammed, if you would please instruct our participants as to how to register their questions again, that would be great.
Certainly, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question.
Dr. Weinstein, this is Leslie. There's one that came across the chat, so let's get with that one. Any recommendation to use a 3% CHG product, such as ChloraScrub, rather than a 2% such as ChloraPrep? They're looking to try to do some cost savings with that reduction.
To use a 3% rather than a 2%? I don't know of any comparative trials. 3%, of course, is more concentrated than 2%, so the question is whether you're going to be doing it for just a single prep or in an ongoing fashion. We found that 2% was very effective in reducing skin contamination, but I don't know of any comparative trials. I know that 4%, when looked at in an ongoing way that is used repeatedly, did lead to more drying of skin.
Okay, thank you. Mohammed, do we have any questions on the line?
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone.
Okay, in the meantime, here's another one. Please compare and contrast oral pharyngeal decolonization with chlorhexidine to the recently reported oral pharyngeal selective decontamination with antibiotics.
Okay, so in the New England Journal of Medicine, in January 1, I think it was, the Dutch group, Mark Bonten and colleagues, published a study looking at oral decontamination with antimicrobial agents. That group has also looked at chlorhexidine oral decontamination, and they've looked at colistin and a number of other antimicrobials. I think their feeling is that there, and I think they comment on this in the last paragraph of the discussion, that probably they're pretty similar in terms of efficacy. The benefit, presumably, of chlorhexidine is you're much less likely to select for antimicrobial resistance when you compare that to antibiotics that are being used. Resistance to antiseptics tends to be less common than resistance to antibiotics. So I think that... and it's, I think it's easier to use, too, the oral chlorhexidine. There are preparations available, generically 0.12% chlorhexidine. So I personally would favor the chlorhexidine, and I think the outcomes would be similar, and I think there are studies showing the benefits of the chlorhexidine by that Dutch group and by other researchers. The JAMA article that I presented as part of my talk actually used oral chlorhexidine and had pretty dramatic effects from it. That was from Segers et al., S-E-G-E-R-S, in JAM in 2006. So I would favor chlorhexidine. I think the clinical outcomes would be similar, and I think the risks of resistance would be less. And I think just from a logistics standpoint, it's easier to do because there are products available.
Okay, thank you. That's very good. Mohammed, I see a lot in the chat. Has anyone had any questions through the phone line?
Yes, ma'am. We actually have a question from the line of Claudester Stevens with the Summa Health System. Please proceed with your question.
Hello, Dr. Weinstein. Quick question. Would you repeat the 5 organisms again that you believe that we need to do additional environmental decontamination? And then the next question is about how often should we do this additional environmental decontamination after the patient is discharged on a daily basis? What are your recommendations there?
So the 5 bugs that I think show increased rates related to the environment, and it varies from one bug to the next about how important the environment is, but VRE, vancomycin-resistant or cocci, Clostridium difficile, those two tend to be the most linked to the environment, and then Acinetobacter, Pseudomonas, and MRSA. So those 5 bugs. It's not known really, for instance, for C. diff, should you be using bleach every day, just at the end of the hospital stay when they're sent somewhere, when they're discharged. That's not known. The experience of Dr. Hayden that was on the slide that I showed, that's published in Clinical Infectious Diseases, was just getting a healthcare worker, buildings and grounds, environmental workers, to do what they were supposed to do. And so there doesn't seem to be a failure of the products. There doesn't seem to be a failure of the procedures. The routine procedures in most hospitals and the products in most hospitals are fine. It's the personnel just aren't doing it. They're not using elbow grease. And in fact, if you go to the Journal of Hospital Infection, just published online, and I guess it'll be in a print edition soon, an article by one of my colleagues, Dr. Bala Hota, H-O-T-A, and it describes our experience and Dr. Hayden's experience at Rush looking at the question of personnel, products, or procedures, and that basically routine procedures work for VRE. For C. diff, because it's a spore-forming organism, that's a trickier question, and I've not seen data to let me tell you whether you need to be more aggressive each day or at the when the patient leaves. I would guess each day, but that hasn't been studied.
Okay.
Well, Mohammed, do we have any other calls in the queue?
Yes, ma'am. Our next question comes from the line of Claudia Zeet with the Cleveland Clinic. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, I was wondering if your institution takes any additional precautions other than like contact isolation for your MDRO patients.
So the question is beyond contact precautions. If someone comes in the hospital and we recognize that they have a resistant bug that we've never seen before, so that's like KPC producing gram negative, so Klebsiella pneumoniae that produces a carbapenemase that makes it resistant to imipenem, doripenem, other carbapenem antibiotics, a sort of bug that's been spreading around Brooklyn or Queens, in New York area, and is just now getting out of the Upper East Coast into Northeastern Coast into the Midwest of the United States. When a patient comes in like that or has a very, very bad multi-drug resistant bug, you know, MRSA with a slightly higher MIC to vancomycin, you know, in the 2-4 range, we do add, as a precaution, more to ensure that contact precautions are met, a sitter outside the patient's door to make sure that people going in and out follow contact precautions. We've not gotten to the point where we do additional cleaning, which I think would be a good idea, but we haven't gotten to that point yet.
Okay, thank you. Lauren, how are we with time? I know we started a little bit late, and we've got lots of questions still in the chat queue, but we will take those offline and get the answers to those with from Dr. Weinstein and get those posted along with the audio. So, Lauren, let's hand it back over to you. I'll bet she's on mute. Lauren is on mute. I'll just send her a quick message.
Schultz, I see her line is not in the conference at this time.
Oh, okay. Well, very good.
The benefits of live television, huh?
Okay. Well, here, I can read this. In order to obtain CE credits, please download the evaluation form and return it via fax to the number that you see right there. And we really would like to thank everyone who was on today for participating and sending your questions. And check your email tomorrow for instructions on how to actually access the recording of this presentation. And as I said, we'll work with Dr. Weinstein to get the questions that were in the chat to him so we can get those responses as well. And please remember to visit the Advisor Live webpage on PremierInc.com within the next day or so for the audio recording. We want to thank you for your participation. We want to thank Dr. Weinstein for a fabulous and information-packed presentation, very actionable, very timely. And we wish you a great rest of the day, and goodbye, everyone. Thank you for joining Advisor Live.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.